This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1. This is The Other Side of the News. You're listening to Bob Fetrakis. I'm in the studio with Jerry Bellow, who has a book forthcoming. And again, the title of that book is
My Net War Diaries, Volume 1, Post-Constitutional America.
And some of those writings have appeared at freepress.org, thecolumbusfreepress.com, and in the Free Press. And if you saw, Jerry raised an interesting question, which needs to be discussed, the question of body cameras and police. That's one of the demands of the Action Network that was put together by Al Sharpton. Many people are saying, yes, it's a great idea. But you point out that it's a nonprofit association of police chiefs that are pushing it. And were they not the same people that led the crackdown on the Occupy movement?
Absolutely. And that's provable through an article by my friend Sean Gaynor when he was working at the Bay Guardian. Mm-hmm. I ghosted a bunch of the research for him, and that nonprofit police organization is called PERF, or the Police Executive Research Forum. Many of the board members of PERF are on Obama's panel on police brutality, and they're like, body cameras, body cameras, body cameras. And Obama's like, money for body cameras, here you go, here you go, here you go. But if you look, the problem isn't whether or not is there video. The police are killing people on video all the time, yet there's no prosecutions. It's not a problem that's solvable by technology. It's a problem that's solvable by changing our system of how we deal with murderous policemen.
Yeah, many people have pointed out it's a problem with the prosecution, which works every day with these police. It's the problem of the FOP as a political power, which has tremendous, tremendous say, because people want that endorsement in local elections. And we also should point out that these police chiefs, as most major cities in America, virtually all are, in fact, Democratic cities. So you've got all of those factors. But what about, and this is the issue you raised, here's police officers undercover or in uniform wandering into legitimate First Amendment demonstrations. What are they going to do with those pictures they shot with the body camera?
Not even demonstrations, just walking down the street. You think body camera, you think something that's, you know, they turn it on when they're doing something. A body camera is not just a little camera on their lapel. It's a camera attached to a cellular device, and it's always on. So, and it's either on the policeman's uniform, or it can be built into, disgustingly enough, a pair of Oakley ballistic sunglasses. I don't know whether those come with their own free tub of hair gel. But, okay, so the cop's walking down the street or driving down the street, and every license plate, every face that that camera sees is getting sucked up and put in a database.
Do they have that technology? I know in the past you've written about PRISM for the Free Press, and I'm sure that that's going to show up in your forthcoming book.
That is in the forthcoming book. The body camera issue is not. I completed the work on the book before I started really working
on
body cameras.
But does the body camera integrate with these technologies that are used for the post-constitutional mass surveillance state that the United States has become?
Well, I could give you the easy stock answer. It's video. Apply facial recognition software to it. Now, the fact that the FBI is busy prototyping and working on what they call the NGI, or the Next Generation Identification System, that includes facial recognition software, and that facial recognition software is made by MorphoTrack, which used to be L1 Identity Solutions, Now, we're going to...
Should we be concerned with that?
L1, the L in L1 refers to LaPenta, Michael LaPenta, who is also one of the L's in L3 of Titan L3. So on one hand, he's...
And Titan L3 was, for the listeners, involved in the torturing of prisoners?
That would be the rape and torture of prisoners. It was the Titan L3 contractor that was raping juvenile prisoners at Abu Ghraib. He was not even fired. He was transferred as discipline to a different prison in Iraq. But Titan L3 is also one of the makers of the cellular camera devices. The whole overall system is made by Lockheed Martin, where Michael LaPenta also worked. So you have one guy who's able to touch this in every direction, and then you have a Democrat presidential administration pushing it. You have a bunch of police chiefs that, you know, coordinated the crackdown on Occupy that resulted in more arrests in America than the protests around the last Iranian election resulted in Iran. More people went to jail because of Occupy in 1 week than went to jail in Iran in 6 months.
And it was clear that the FBI was engaging in what appeared to be COINTELPRO, counterintelligence provocative action in Cleveland, right? It was an FBI snitch, somebody they had who had committed a felony, who came up with the idea of blowing up a bridge and using C4. So a couple local guys are talking about a smoke bomb in a bank, and suddenly the FBI guys takes out that whole movement from people who would never be able to get a hold of C4 explosives.
There's one end of that, but that wasn't the coordination of the actual crackdown. The FBI does something eventually, one day. One of our public records requests is going to get it. It's going to touch it. We're going to have it. This crackdown on Occupy was organized through conference calls held by a private entity. The Police Executive Research Forum, although made up of police, big city police chiefs, and has a board that's the who's who of head-cracking demonstrator police chiefs, I can't get their records. You can't get their records. They're a private entity.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not liable. That's the brick wall. The government steps outside the government to carry out some of the repression. We're talking about a private entity coordinating government repression, even though that private entity is made up entirely of government employees.
So that's their little nonprofit association where these big city police chiefs gather and discuss, and you're saying that group was advocating the crackdown on Occupy.
Not advocating, coordinating.
Coordinating. And they what's planned the difference it. There?
They planned it on a very specific conference call.
So you'd think that that would be a public record if they're plotting public activities with public taxpayers' money, but they're hiding behind this nonprofit shield.
Correct, and you can read that in Sean Gaynor's work at the Bay Guardian. And, you know, I back reference that often. That's what put Perf on both me and his radar. And then I raised it again here in an article in the Columbus Free Press. And I've referenced it in other places anytime, like, there they were. But it's the who's who of headcrackers. Tim Dolan, John Timoney, Ramsey, oh, Bratton.
What cities are these guys from?
That's complicated. I mean, Timoney has been chief of police in Philly and was chief of police during the Republican National Convention in the year 2000. I personally attended that one and was lucky to get out with my tuchus intact. But a lot of heads got cracked. And then he was responsible for the so-called Miami model, with the crackdown on the FTAA protests in 2003 in Miami. My friend Jordan did not survive that series of demonstrations.
Meaning?
The police attacked and with there was a basement space that people were using as a makeshift medical clinic. The police did not enter it. What they did was just break one of the windows and throw in a bunch of tear gas grenades. Everybody runs out, gets their butts kicked. People go back in to, you know, reclaim the space. They found an unidentified white powder in some of the bandages. Jordan decontaminated that white powder. 72 hours later, he was dead of meningitis. Now, I can't say that biological weapons were used on demonstrators, or the fact that Jordan was just a gentle guy and all the stress depressed his immune system so much that he became vulnerable to a bacteria in the air. But in the end, my friend is dead, and I blame the state.
So do we have any other evidence suggesting that they have meningitis in biowarfare?
No, but these are the facts.
Okay.
There was a white powder that only he touched. And 72 hours later, he died.
And we know there's a bioweapons program, but we also know there's a crackdown. I don't know if it's a program against whistleblowers, and you know at least one of them personally, do you not?
Yes, Jeremy Hammond is a friend of mine. I wouldn't call him a whistleblower because he has never worked for the government. A whistleblower is somebody who reveals from inside. Jeremy?
Would you call him a hacker?
I would call him a hacktivist. Yeah, he broke into by his own admission, broke into a lot of both private and government computers and revealed the information from private security corporations to the public. Revealed a lot that has been written about in the last 4 years, not just by myself, but by quite a few people. And he revealed it anonymously. I was writing about some of this stuff, and we were reading about some of this stuff long before he was arrested, and his arrest was the first that I knew that he was in any way involved in this.
And was he connected to Barrett Brown, who got a tremendous amount of attention?
Yeah, Barrett Brown is in prison for posting a link to otherwise posted material that Jeremy originally acquired.
So when people talk about the deep internet and say there's the surface internet, but there's a whole nother realm, what are we talking about there?
A marketing fantasy.
Is that, but is there not a whole internet that is accessed and known to the surveillance agencies that that some people are aware of and can access?
There is only one set of protocols to address any machine that is on the internet. It is either addressable by the same protocol that will get you to CNN or it's not. There's no separate, you have to use some extra numbers part of the internet.
And what do the extra numbers get you?
Not a damn thing.
So if you wanted to access server farms or those things, say in 2004 when they shipped that stuff down to vote counts from Ohio, down to Chattanooga, Tennessee, we don't see that as, or is that just a visible part of the internet that they're utilizing that we're not
just
aware of?
It's just because it's addressable. I mean, every computer that is on the internet can be addressed. It has an address. Either I can send it a packet of information, or I can't.
But does the government have computers we're not aware of? Is there any way to be aware of them?
They're either connected to the network and addressable, or they're not. Right? There's a quad octet. There's a series of numbers between 0 and 256. There are four of them. Either you've got them, either you're the at least the router that you're attached to has one of those, or it doesn't.
This is WCRS, your community radio. You're listening to the other side of the news.
They're, like, if it doesn't have that number, it's not on the internet.
All right. Well, let's go back to your book. First of all, the name of the book, My Net War Diaries. What kind of stuff is in your diaries, and why should somebody want to read it?
Well, the book begins with the story I did on the announcement of Jeremy's plea agreement, and it's a series of 57 articles split into 7 chapters, and then chronological within chapter.
So are the 7 chapters thematic?
Yes.
And what are they? Could you go over them?
I address the judiciary, the executive, Congress, the military.
So when you say you address
the media,
you address the judiciary. Are you looking at actual court decisions that have shaped
court decisions and laws that govern the jurisdiction of certain courts? Both.
Okay, and then so you have the Congress, you have the executive branch. What else did you say?
Hacktivists and whistleblowers, the media, private corporations, and I also had a brief look at some of the actual technologies, where those technologies are available for me to examine in any way.
Well, part of the research and writing you're known for is linking nonprofit investment firms, CIA,
yeah,
into products that look like surveillance products.
Yeah, and that actually is, that research is going to be expanded over the next year in a forthcoming book. Although I do touch on it a lot, I'm looking at certain private investment firms that repeatedly invest in certain technologies along with the CIA. The CIA has a nonprofit that is a private equity firm. They invest in technologies. They make companies with ideas that they like successful and then sell out their interest. Their only interest is to have a technology that they feel has promise be available to be purchased later.
Now, is this any different? I mean, the original internet in part was brought to us by Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, government grants, war grants that went to Menlo Park, which I think you may be referencing in your book. Hasn't the government always been involved in the internet and this type of activity? Why is it different now?
The original internet was designed to link all of the supercomputing, link the military and all of the supercomputing labs at all the major universities together in a redundant network. And that was a Defense Advanced Research Agency project. Not a secret, above ground, and eventually it developed for civilian use and people ran with it. I mean, the internet is older than people think, but it was never a secret. It was not, even in 1967 and 1968, when they were figuring out how to do it and they just wanted to link all these computers together for the first time. It was not a top secret project.
Engelbart went to a conference and made his famous display of here's the mouse, here's the internet. Here's how we can talk to other computers from Stanford to Utah and wherever they were sent.
Yeah, I mean,
they weren't hiding it.
Civilian professors with no interest in computers, biology professors, were sending each other email in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally developed by the military, essentially taken over by academics, and then Al Gore didn't invent the internet, he commercialized it or facilitated its greatly further commercialization.
Through government funding.
And yeah, through government funding and through government givebacks of bandwidth.
So you've used the term post-constitutional America. Why should we think of the United States as post-constitutional? Isn't this internet a good thing?
It's not the internet that makes America post-constitutional. It's how America relates to the Constitution, how the government relates to the Constitution, to its core document, and how the surveillance state views the global public. It views the global public as an enemy to be controlled. And this, when I say post-constitutional, I am not talking about the Bill of Rights. I'm talking about the Articles. That there's to be a separation of powers, that there's to be checks and balances. But when the secret state overrides that, then the Constitution is not a functional document.
So when the CIA spies on the Senate?
Right. When the CIA, we can go further back than that. When the CIA gives itself the right to withhold information from the Senate, which funds it, there, right there, with that act, the Constitution is no longer a functional document. The Constitution was constructed by a Congress. This nation was constructed by a Congress, by broad representatives, not that the original Constitutional Congress was very, or even the original Continental Congress was very broad, but as broad as they could get representation of the people coming together to create foundational documents, and this is how we are going to do things as a nation. That goes out the window, and that form goes out the window, and you no longer have a functional document. You now have a nation that is functioning in an era that is post that document having any real meaning.
So your net war diaries, are you a guerrilla fighter?
No, I'm a journalist and a programmer.
And how does a journalist get in the middle of a net war?
A journalist is always in the middle of a net war. You have to understand what a net war is. It's not hacker on hacker in the internet, whoever types the fastest wins.
It's not like spy versus spy in Mad Magazine, hacker versus hacker.
Right, yeah.
But I've seen the Hollywood movies. It's always like whoever does the keyboard the quickest wins.
No, it don't work like that. It's actually whoever stays up the latest eating the most junk food comes up with something nifty is how that actually works. The net war is about struggle between networks of people that include at least one non-state actor in a less than total war environment. So an arrest in a political context is part of a net war. Putting out a newspaper is part of a net war. A drone strike is part of a net war. Anything less than...
Why a drone strike?
Because it's targeted on an individual or a group of people. It's not part of a total war where, like, a war between two states. Now you have a war between a state and... or a struggle between a state and one or more non-state actors, or a struggle between two sets of non-state actors that are working as networks, not as hierarchies. Although you can have each node in that network be a small or large hierarchy or another network in and of itself. That theory of warfare was put out in the 90s by the Rand Corporation. I read their founding papers when I was in college. And as I watched, I covered Jeremy, and as I watched the Snowden revelations start to unfold, I'm like, I read about this, I know this, I've seen this, this is happening. And I'd been following the authors who put that theory out as their theory developed over the 90s and into the 2000s, and I'm watching them quote anarchists. Quote anarchists about how demonstrations happen. Quote anarchists about the Battle of Seattle. And I watched them use my friends' statements as proof of their military theories. And so I'm in this weird feedback loop where I'm reading their ideas, talking about their ideas. People are putting their ideas in practice, and they're watching it happen and saying, see, that's what's going on. This is how it's happening. And then I'm watching the Snowden revelations happen and all the politics that happen around that. And I'm writing about it, and I'm like, oh, I know this. Oh, I so know this. I've seen this before. I always knew this was going to happen. And so I grouped the articles together. I put them in a framework. I explained the lens. What I did was explain the lens that I'm viewing this all through. And there you have a book that helps put what is happening in surveillance against the global public within the context of how it was constructed by the government and their theorists, how it's viewed by me, how it's viewed by other people who understand it, and so that you can understand it. But within the context of net war, a hacker is a combatant, a journalist is a combatant. If information is a weapon and I'm putting information out there, then I'm involved in the net war.
So the net wars are really info or information wars. How does Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, and the whole Arab Spring fit into that theory of net wars or information wars?
Well, think of Chelsea Manning as a node putting out information. That information is used by WikiLeaks to prove a point. That point gets proved to people in Tunisia and elsewhere, and through the distributed networks of civil society, an uprising region-wide happens. The governments there clamp down on that uprising and start shutting off Twitter, and then hacktivists in the first world help people there bypass the government's filters, hide from the government, continue to talk on Twitter even though it's shut off. And that's where people in Anonymous played a role in cross-cultural and international facilitation of communication to allow people in Tunisia and Egypt to talk to people in Tunisia and Egypt and be their authentic selves and do what needed to be done. You can lose you can't win an information war if you don't know what it's about. If you can't define victory, if you can't define who's on what side.
So if you want to find out what an information war is about, a net war, read the forthcoming book by Jerry Bellow, My
Net War Diaries.
My Net War Diaries.
Post-Constitutional America. Volume 1, Post-Constitutional America. There will be a Volume 2 and a Volume 3 within the next 12 to 18 months.
All right. Thanks for being on the show. This is Bob Fitrakis, bringing you the other side of the news.